Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Today I have with me Eric Steffel, and he's a paramedic down in Houston, Texas. He's here to talk to us about something that really you hear about in the literature and podcasts and everything else, but no one really does a detailed discussion on this topic. Well, Eric approached me to talk about this, and I thought, what the hell, why not? Let's go ahead and cover this now. But before we get into this topic, Eric, can you give us a brief introduction of yourself?
So I've been in EMS for 18 years, and 14 of that, I've been a paramedic. I originally started up in Ohio in Defiance and Toledo area. And about 2006, I moved down to Texas. And actually there shortly after, I ended up joining the Army National Guard. Was in there for 8 years with one deployment to Afghanistan. After I got back from my deployment, I started getting into the education side for EMS. And really been primarily doing that for about the last 6 years or so. Worked with a couple different services down here, and each one of them just kind of progressing my impact on paramedic education and performance.
All right, so let's talk about what active exhalation is. And this is the topic of today's nice little podcast here. And so we're going to talk a lot more about it than pretty much anything you've probably heard of up to this point on anything else. And it's really kind of cool. It's something you can do easy. And as Eric likes to point out, it's free. So that's always a huge bonus. But before we get too involved in what the actual intervention is, you had a case to give us. So why don't we go with that real quick?
Absolutely. So late at night, you have a 6-year-old male who developed an asthma attack. Mom's taking care of the kid, but the kid's got, unfortunately, a long history of a bad asthma, and actually he's been intubated several times before. So mom was trying to treat the kid, but unfortunately this time the kid went south. By the time the ambulance arrived, the patient's obtunded, marked respiratory distress, audible wheezing, really struggling to breathe. The crew starts oxygen, albuterol, patient's side, moved out to the ambulance, but this kid is going downhill very quickly. Shortly after getting the back of the ambulance, goes apneic. BVM ventilation has started, but unfortunately, O2 sats continue to drop. Bradycardia begins to emerge. Endotracheal intubation was performed immediately, but during the attempt, was unable to get a 5.5 tube that was cuffed and ended up having to go with a 5.0 tube, which is uncuffed for the service that we're at. So unfortunately, the airway resistance now is persistent. And a lot of the air that's being ventilated into the tube is actually escaping around the ET tube out, and the lungs are not getting ventilated. Lung compliance is very poor and persistent. End-tidal CO2 waveform is consistent, but it's remaining in the low 20s. Bradycardia eventually evolved into a systole, and now CPR started. Although these patients are rare, the CDC does report that asthma patients are increasing, and I think it's fair to say that this is going to become a more common event that we're going to see with battling asthma and sicker patients like this. But when we have these patients, it's fair to say that it's always an uphill battle, and it can rarely rattle even the most experienced provider, especially when the interventions that we're performing are not actually having a positive impact and the patient continues to deteriorate.
So there is a lot of information in this, and we see these patients rather often, usually not this severe, but sometimes it does happen. But pretty much anytime you're going to intubate one of these patients, the tube itself is not fixing anything. It may help provide the respirations for the patient so the patient can now be at rest because they're going to be in a pretty sad state. But that, again, doesn't actually fix the issue. And something you mentioned was the back valve mask ventilation. I mean, that's kind of going to be our first step to help assist with those ventilations, especially in the pre-hospital setting, but in the hospital as well. The problem is that I'm sure in this case, just like in most of these cases, these patients are incredibly hard to back, which is part of the reason why you don't have much success and you have this continued desaturation, which ends up going to the intubation. So what can we do to help this out? Well, Eric and I have talked about this, and there's this nice little basic approach as part of basically severe asthma interventions, but it's not something that's a medication, which is what is so much of the actual interventions currently, but is a simple little maneuver. So Eric, can we talk a little bit about that?
The intervention is under the theory of, we've said it for a long time now, these patients are air trapping. And I want to even kind of discuss a little bit of the using a ventilator to ventilate these patients afterwards. A setting to change on that is we want to decrease the ventilation time and increase the exhalation phase as much as possible, so that we allow these patients to naturally exhale. But my argument on it is, why don't we actively exhale this patient? So if I could actually give a comparison, so if a patient is sedated in apneic, then we have an inhalation problem. And we solve that by providing positive pressure ventilation. So if the patient is air trapping, then we have an exhalation problem. And we can solve that by providing positive pressure exhalation, or in this case, what we're calling active exhalation.
All right. And so how does this fit in with everything else about the severe asthma patients? So typically, these patients are getting like beta agonists, steroids. These are the two things that pretty much any asthma patient who's going to present to the ED or EMS is going to get. But then, of course, we progress where we start using magnesium or ketamine or terbutaline or epinephrine, you know, all these different types of medications to try and help this bronchoconstriction that's going on. But obviously, again, these patients just slowly get worse. And usually right before we intubate them, they're altered because of the acidosis and because of the hypercarbia and the just general weakness and fatigue that's going on, to the point that they really can no longer do it. And I mean, sometimes we try the non-invasive. We usually try and do that first, but it doesn't work out. And then we end up doing intubation. Again, this doesn't really fix our main issue here. So at this point, this is where we start talking about doing the active exhalation. Now, you could potentially do it sooner than that, but usually with the actual procedure itself, it tends to be easier on someone who is well obtunded, honestly, because you're pushing on someone's chest a little forcibly.
So absolutely, you bring up a good point where we've already exhausted all of our efforts to oxygenate this patient. So there is no pre-oxygenation phase to this procedure. It's just go to it and get it done. So for the unconscious patient, which is arguably going to be the easier patient to do this on, you put both hands on each side of the chest and you push down. Now, I want to note that this is not a chest compression. You're just simply trying to squeeze the lungs, to squeeze the air out of them. I tend to like a vertical approach just because mechanics, some suggested coming in from a more of a lateral approach, but you're using more muscle and not really using the mechanics to your advantage. But once you start to push, you just push down for about 8 to 10 seconds. And again, I kind of base this duration on what I'm hearing. So when I do this, I absolutely want to have a stethoscope under my hand and listening to the lungs, and then also monitoring end-tidal CO2 as much as possible, because you will see a marked increase in that end-tidal CO2 in that case.
You mentioned this really quickly about the end-tidal CO2, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this more here in a second, but this is something that you really need to know and expect, because this can absolutely throw you off. But before that, I just want to mention with the chest and doing this, basically you're doing anterior-posterior approach. So your hands are wrapping around the sides, kind of getting the axilla. The heel of your palm is going to be on the anterior portion of the chest. That's usually kind of how you see it. And then, as Eric said, you're basically pushing straight down. So if you're standing over the patient, they're on the bed, you want to make sure they have a hard surface behind them too, to help with the mechanics of this. But it's like an anterior posterior movement, and much like what you would do for a chest compression. But again, you're not pushing the middle of the chest, you're pushing off to the sides of the chest, and you're pushing downward in that same kind of motion. And this is not something quick like a chest compression. This is nice and slow over the course of several seconds. But one of the things you're doing is, like he says, like you're auscultating, well, at the same time you have the end-tidal CO2 going on. And think about this for a second. When you have all this air trapping, well, what's being trapped? Well, a lot of this is going to be CO2. So what's going to happen as you're pushing this out? Well, your end-tidal CO2 is going to drastically increase. And you're talking about, you're seeing end-tidal CO2 is up in like the 120s range. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I've seen one case that was, and actually the case presentation we're talking about today, go up to just over 120.
That's something to see with the unconscious patient. What about when they're awake and you decide to do this?
So I haven't personally done this on an awake patient, but I have one of the medics that I trained this procedure on went and took it and used it on an awake patient. And what he did was basically push on the chest for about 3 seconds, which was based on the patient's tolerance level. And he did that twice, essentially almost back to back, and pushed and was able to see almost an immediate improvement. And I want to note on this little case report here that the intubation kit was already out. It was set up. He was ready to go and ended up averting the intubation, and the patient ended up didn't really resolve his problems, but avoided intubation when they got the hospital, started continuing to improve. So overall, it averted the intubation.
And as a note for, at least in my thought of this process, again, I've never done this on an awake patient, but in theory, I would think that this would probably be the point where the patient is so bad off, we're probably on our way to intubation, or maybe we're on our way to DSI at least, or, you know, basically we're trying to do whatever we can. This may be what I do with ketamine on board. So especially if this is someone who's at the point where they're getting altered, to really try and push on someone's chest while they're altered is not going to be fun for anyone. So this may be at the point where, and this is nice because you can do this pre-hospitally or in the hospital, you give them a little bit of ketamine, and once that ketamine starts kicking in and doing its thing, now you've got them calmed down enough that you can actually do your chest compression, your active exhalation compression, and that will help facilitate this process. And if the patient's still bad off, you end up intubating them, but you may not always have to, depending on what your service says and what your protocols are for your hospital or your EMS system. You may have to still intubate them, but at least the intubation is going to be a hell of a lot easier than what it would have been without doing this procedure first.
The report from the medic back was that the look in the patient's face during the pushing on the chest during the active exhalation was disconcerting, and it was not a pleasant experience for the patient. Afterwards, you know, he said, "How do you feel? Do you feel better?" And it was a look of relief on the patient's face.
You literally knocked the wing out of the patient. I'm sure they're not going to be super excited about that.
Yeah, I'm suffocating. Don't push on my chest.
It's worth noting one other thing before we move on and talk about the evidence side of this, which is actually mostly limited, but there's some good stuff out there, is that we got to be smart about who we're using this on. This is not for every patient who we're talking about intubating or who is having a hard time breathing. This is going to be more for the patients who have, again, the air trapping issues. Eric, can you talk a little more about that?
On your asthma and potentially your COPD patients, we're looking for the patient that has air trapping, has bronchial constriction. Your emphysema patients, they have an elasticity problem. Your cystic fibrosis, or even your CHFers that are wheezing, those patients are not going to benefit from this. And I would actually steer away from saying, hey, let's use this as a diagnostic tool. We should be doing it going in with the ideology that this is going to help this patient, not, well, let's just try this and find out. And it's not a risk-free, you know, anything that we do to a patient has its potential risk. So I wouldn't just do it to anybody.
All right, so let's talk about some of the evidence that you found on this subject.
So there really wasn't mounds of evidence. Matter of fact, I had a lot of troubles even digging out articles and studies that even referenced active exhalation. And when it did, it basically referenced the patients that were still using their own diaphragms. For example, like COPD patients using pursed lip breathing and active exhalation as a lung training. And then also for bronchopulmonary dysplasia patients for pediatrics as a method to basically do the same thing to improve pediatrics lung conditions. So that was about it. I didn't find anything that was actually implementing this or studied this as a procedure in the emergent setting for resolving or not really resolving, but temporizing these bronchoconstrictive patients.
I mean, these patients in the first place are pretty rare anyway. Most of these patients are not coming to us in a crashing state and end up needing intubation. So that makes it hard because this is not a big body of people that we're looking for. And then because of that, it makes it hard to do proper trials on. It's not like we're going to do an RCT when we have only maybe a few patients a year who have this issue. It's hard to turn around and say, well, we're going to do every other one where we do active exhalation or not, because when you have a problem that shows up only maybe every few months, or depending on your setting, maybe even less often than that, it's going to be really, really hard to do the proper randomization to do that. And it's going to take years before you get anywhere close to enough people to actually do any sort of study with it. So this is something that is really just going to be based on observation studies, which again are not strong pieces of evidence, but when you've got nothing, and especially when you're talking about an overall low risk situation, it may not be a bad idea to stick with this. But again, at this point, this is almost entirely anecdotal with some minor evidence behind it. So it's very much important that when you do this, that you make sure you have the proper stuff in place to basically support these decisions, and that you make sure that everyone's on board, everyone understands what you're doing, because I'm pretty sure your team may also get really surprised if you're not using a shared mental model, and the next thing you know, you're pushing on someone's chest. They'll probably get really thrown off by this. So it's important that everyone's on the same side. You've got some ways to defend what you're doing, making sure you explain why you're doing something like this. But overall, this is something that is, you know, basically free. You're not talking about something that where people are going to have to do a lot of things. Really, overall, this is something that's, again, going to be a nice, clean, safe method to do. But you just have to know that there is very limited evidence on this, and we do still have some risks. So, Eric, let's talk about some of these risks that could happen.
So the biggest risk that I can think of is the fact that we're pushing the patient's chest and changing their interthoracic pressures. But again, this is only for a brief time. So the first thing that comes to concern is going to be hypotension that may lead to arrest. But fortunately, in these cases that we're using these patients on, hypotension is typically not already there. We're not dealing with a crashing CHF patient that's about to arrest. We're dealing with a patient that has an oxygenation problem. But if they are already peri-arrest, I think we would all agree that cardiac arrest is bad for our patients, but the corrective action to oxygenation would potentially be more beneficial as opposed to simply continuing to attempt to ventilate your air-trapped patient. And let's face it, if they arrest due to oxygenation and they are already air-trapped to that point, ventilation afterwards is already going to cause a thoracic output problem and cardiac arrest. So the second risk that I can think of is injury to the lung or chest wall. So again, this is not a chest compression as in cardiac resuscitation, but we still are pushing on the patient's chest, so we could potentially break cartilage or a rib, which if anybody breaks a rib doing this, it is hopefully just a severely decalcified patient and we're not applying too much force inappropriately to them. But outside of that, I mean, I can't really think of any other significant risk to this.
And that's the thing I'm thinking of when I think about the risk for this as far as the chest wall injuries. This is probably someone that if you do break a rib, either you're doing this too hard and fast, like a chest compression, or simply this is someone who, this is the 80-year-old grandma with severe osteoporosis that even if you flicked her, would probably have a broken rib in the end. So this is probably someone that you're not going to be too worried about this, but in most of our patients who are truly crashing asthmatics or COPDers that you're going to do this to, they're probably going to be otherwise healthy or at least younger and are going to be the ones that we're probably not going to have these issues to start with.
And I do want to actually go back and highlight one thing. I know I kind of mentioned it before, but make sure you have your stethoscope on the chest when you do this, because if you're not hearing that wheeze that you're really looking for, and there's really two different phases. You're going to hear the normal wheeze as you would listen, you know, take a deep breath, you're going to hear that wheeze. But then as you're pushing on the chest, there's going to go to a second phase where the tone of that wheeze is going to change as you're getting into that trapped air finally exiting out of those bronchi. And hearing that transition really helps confirm that what you're doing is helping. And if you don't hear this, then you probably should stop and not either continue or don't keep pushing harder. And that's one of the ways to kind of mitigate that risk.
And this is a really high-pitched kind of whine usually, right?
Correct. Believe it or not, so you hear that high pitch, and then on that second phase when you get in that trapped air, it actually tends to go to more of a higher pitch and it slows down slightly. It's really hard to explain, but the first time you hear it, there's a clear transition and it's a way to help confirm that you're doing the right procedure for the right patient.
Basically, it's really hard to describe it, but when you hear it, you'll know that this is what's going on.
Yep, pretty much.
I know you want to talk about basically last couple of parts with this. So why don't we go into the next stage of our little conversation here?
When I reached out to you on this, I really wanted to just kind of highlight something because, like you said, this is not patients that we have very often, but when we have them, one, they are viable patients. These are patients who shouldn't die. I mean, this, if anything, I mean, maybe this could be, you know, the tourniquet for asthma. You know, there's no reason why somebody should die from extremity hemorrhage. And so let's bring this over to the airway side. Nobody should die from an asthma attack, but unfortunately, it happens. And maybe this is that procedure that could be the tipping point to temporize them until all of our traditional treatments start kicking in, because we still want to do our beta agonists. We still want to do our ventilation, but this is maybe something that kind of changes the game. And plus, again, it's zero cost. It's free. But if anything, when I reached out to you on this, I wanted to also hopefully spark somebody out there to either do some case reports or put some data together. This isn't something that happens that often. So we need a larger group of people to pull this data together to say, hey, how well has this worked for everybody? And maybe we can put something better together and give our patients an answer, a simple treatment that's going to bring them back around and avoid cardiac arrest.
So basically, if you're listening to this, you've done this before, especially if you've done this several times, and also looking at Eric here, because I mean, this is something that you could also do on the EMS side of this. But really, if you've done this before, especially if you've done it several times, try and publish something on this, because like we said, there's very little evidence on this right now. And the more that's out there, the better chance this is to get research more in the future and that we can actually do something about this where more people are using this regularly.
And I'm sure you're going to throw up my email address. Absolutely. Send me the information. Send Chip the information. You know, we could potentially be the epicenter of this, and we can start just putting this data together, you know, and start looking at it and say, hey, does this work for everybody?
I like that, the epicenter. Without further ado, I think we are down to the one last part that we really need to talk about. You gave us a case. Let's talk about the resolution of the case.
So after CPR was initiated, the IO was started, and then EPI was administered, going down the regular ACLS resuscitation for a pediatric patient. And I stopped and I thought to myself, active exhalation. I stopped and I let everyone know, hey, this is what we're doing. There's a handful of people that looked at me a little weird, but I said, just trust me on this. We stopped CPR on the count of three. It was a well-coordinated move. I performed active exhalation. I watched the monitor. The patient was in a systole, and the end tidal continued to increase over the 8 seconds. And this is when it peaked over 120. CPR was immediately continued after that. And the very next ventilation was reported to be extremely compliant. About 1 to 2 minutes later, the patient regained pulses and ROSC was achieved. He still remained unconscious, but during transport, ventilation resistance continued to increase. So we started seeing some oxygen drop, oxygen saturation drop, and then bradycardia start to emerge. So we did it one more time, active exhalation. We pushed in the chest for about 8 seconds. I auscultated, heard an excellent transition and wheeze. And again, we had an immediate response from the patient. The hypoxia and bradycardia was immediately resolved, and the patient did not rearrest. When we got to the hospital, transferred care over to the staff, and the patient was ultimately admitted to the ICU.
Something worth noting there real quick. Not only was this a very successful situation and a great case to talk about, but you actually had to do this multiple times, which is not uncommon with this, because there's usually underlying pathology has not yet been fixed. So it's being worked on, but we still have the issue there. So the air trapping can last for a little bit. So I'm glad that you mentioned that in this case, that you may have to do this multiple times before you can finally correct the underlying issue.
And maybe I didn't highlight it very well, but all of our traditional treatments that we're doing, we're still doing in the background. This doesn't replace anything. This is just a tool in the toolbox to temporize your patient till our traditional treatments start to kick in and work.
With all that said, Eric, is there anything else you want to add?
I think the hardest part about this is actually incorporating it into your thought process when caring for the patient. So what I did as a reminder to myself is in my head, in the tool set of CPAP and intubation for patients that are asthmatic or air trapping, I put this as do this first, kind of like vagal maneuver for SVT. You think, well, I need a adenocard. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. I need to do this other simple free tactic to change the heart rate. So that's what I did. I put it in there, and there's times that I occasionally either delayed or forget about it for a minute, but going back to it and saying, oh, yeah, let me do this. So in your brain, just kind of put that right next to it, and that'll help you remember and identify these rare cases when it could really make a difference.
All that is great stuff, Eric, and hopefully we can have you back on sometime in the future to talk about some more interesting topics like this. But until next time, can you give us the tagline?
Absolutely. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.